You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Scene Stealer. For years, a Grey's Anatomy writer spilled her personal traumas in online essays and wove the details into the show's plot, until a surprising email to Shondaland accused her of making it all up. And that's not even the most shocking part of the true lies of Elizabeth Finch by Evgenia Peretz, with opening illustration by Kinsuke Koike, which shows a fragmented portrait of a woman. In February 2014, television writer Elizabeth Finch wrote about her diagnosis of chondrosarcoma, a rare and usually fatal form of bone cancer, in an Elle magazine article that seemed tailor-made for TV. Not only did the writer have a harrowing personal story, currency in Hollywood, her dialogue had a dramatic punch. The doctor said, "There's something we need to discuss. Chondrosarcoma. I've never seen anything like this, especially in someone your age. Nothing about this is going to be easy." Finch was a feisty woman in a man's world, and she channeled the doctor nicknaming conventions of a certain hit medical TV show. "When I defied Dr. Cryptic's orders to take an indefinite leave of absence from work, he thought chemo deserved my sole attention. He doubted my commitment to getting well. And when it came to work, she was a writer on the Vampire Diaries. She was unstoppable. I watched the producer's cuts under a fog of Demerol, punched up dialogue about vampire-werewolf hybrids with a shunt in my spine. Yes, I was down 17 pounds, bald, vomiting relentlessly, but I was still living alone, still stubborn as hell." Shortly after the article's publication, a development executive at Shondaland, the production company of writer-producer powerhouse Shonda Rhimes, presented Finch to the showrunner of Grey's Anatomy, then in its 10th season, as a potential hire. The writer soon met with Rhimes herself. Everyone involved had been impressed with the Elle article. At the end of the meeting, Rhimes offered the young woman her dream job. Less than 5 years later, a version of Finch's cancer story was beamed around the world to millions of Grey's Anatomy viewers. "Anybody Have a Map" is one of 13 episodes that Finch wrote and one of 172 that she produced. The setting is an upscale bar. Tom Karakik, the cocksure star surgeon played by Greg German, has just learned the likely diagnosis of his friend and fellow surgeon Catherine Avery, played by the fabulous Debbie Allen, Finch's avatar. "Chondro is a beast," he tells her, referring to chondrosarcoma. "We know it's deadly serious because he's dropped his jocular shtick. Doesn't respond to chemo, so if you're lucky, and it's a big if, we may be able to cut it out without making me a quadriplegic," Catherine interrupts, "which means I'll never operate again." The pressure is on Tom. Yes, he's the best there is. But as he later confides to Dr. Meredith Grey, Ellen Pompeo, on a street corner, "I have no idea how to remove it without killing or paralyzing her." Elizabeth, as Debbie, as Catherine, isn't having it. She tells them to get their asses in gear to save her and delivers a speech about her tenacity. "I survived losing my mother before I could even get to know her, and my father, who dropped dead on his way to church when I was 18 years old. I raised my sisters alone, no help, no money. I have survived racism, sexism, every ism designed to make me feel small and make me less. If I can do all of that, if I can survive all of that, then I just might survive this too. But I can't do this on my own. So I need you to figure it out, fast. Excuse me, I have to go call my husband. Moments later, there's a wrap-up kernel of wisdom spoken in voiceover by her husband, Dr. Richard Weber, played by James Pickens, Jr. The problem with all the how-to, step-by-step books, they don't take into account the exceptions to the rules. They never leave room for the outliers, the geniuses, the miracles. Everyone in Finchie's world, as they called her, believed she was that miracle. Not only was chondrosarcoma unheard of in someone her age, but she was, incredibly, living with it since 2012. In fact, she was the only one in her clinical trial who survived. She showed up so bravely to the Grey's Anatomy writer's room, a scarf over her bald head, and she so inspired everyone around her that they did whatever they could to support. Her bosses gave her all the time off she needed to participate in her maintenance chemo and clinical trials at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. Friends there drove her to and from appointments. When cancer storylines came up on the show, Finch led the way. She was the expert. And she even chronicled her experience with chondrosarcoma on the side, in Elle and The Hollywood Reporter, and on Shondaland.com to promote her episodes. She wasn't one to draw attention to herself. No, cancer, alas, had become her brand. Other terrible things seemed to befall Finch, some of which she chronicled for the world, some of which she talked about in select company. Against all medical odds due to her cancer treatments, she became pregnant. She faced the awful dilemma of aborting the fetus or dying if she wanted to carry it because she'd have to cease treatment. She chose to have an abortion. There was the kidney transplant she needed due to something cancer-related. A dear friend was killed in the Tree of Life Synagogue massacre in Pittsburgh, where Finch went to college, and she helped clean the friend's remains off the floor. The FBI allowed it. Her brother, Finch was realizing in midlife, had abused her many years ago. Then he took his own life. Well, not quite. He was so vindictive that he was intentionally unsuccessful, and Finchie was the one who had to pull the plug. She was the Job of the Disney lot. Then, in February of this year, just as Rhymes was dropping the splashy first release she created under her Netflix deal, Inventing Anna, about con artist Anna Delvey, she received an email on her private account. It was from an unlikely sender, Jennifer Beyer, a struggling mother of five from Kansas and a registered nurse who had married Finch in 2020, though they were by now estranged. And its message was not just unlikely, but unthinkable. Finch, Beyer wrote, had been telling stories, and it was time to stop believing her. Rhymes knew of Beyer. She had even advised Finch about matters concerning the couple's future together and Beyer's kids. But this time, Rhymes did not respond, and did not respond. If what Beyer was saying was true, Rhymes and all of Shondaland had been Delveyed, as had Finch's friends and family members. Only she wasn't stealing people's money. She was taking their empathy and tears, as well as other people's personal traumas, which she would call her own. In response to detailed questions for Finch regarding information from multiple sources, her attorney, Andrew Brettler, contended that not all of Beyer's claims were true and asserted that Beyer was neither reliable nor unbiased because the two women are in the midst of a highly contentious divorce. People close to Finch, from the distinct compartments of her life, have been grappling with the idea that the woman they loved may not exist. Those who've known Finch the longest have looked back at her young life for clues. At least from the outside, Finch's early life seems fairly normal. She grew up in a middle-class Jewish family in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. She was bat mitzvahed, went to Jewish summer camp, attended Cherry Hill East High School. It had a strong theater department, and she wrote plays that people appreciated. She was sharp and funny and spunky. She made lasting friendships with smart, warm people. She had an older brother, Eric. Her mother, Joan, was a special education teacher. Her father, Robert, had a less solid career, according to a source close to the family, but she was loved. In her early adulthood, Finch was surrounded by cancer, for real. While she was in college at Carnegie Mellon, her mother was diagnosed with cancer. She learned all about what went into that. 5 years into her mother's diagnosis, as Finch later wrote, "Our family were all experts in pharmacology, wig design, hip hospital lingo, and fashioning surreptitious means of throwing up in public places." Her mother survived. After a stint at USC Film School, Finch worked as an assistant to television writer Rick Cleveland. When Cleveland's mother got sick with stage 4 lung cancer, she went out of her way to do research for him. Then, when Cleveland's close friend's wife got breast cancer, she was helpful to him and his family. "Mensch is the word I would use to describe her," wrote Cleveland in an email, bristling at the suggestion that she could have been untruthful. He introduced her to Alan Ball, creator of True Blood, and she got her first job as a junior TV writer. During that period, Finch wrote about cancer publicly for the first time for a personal essay site called Fresh Yarn. After it was clear her mother would survive, she herself took the test for the BRCA gene mutation, she wrote, and it came back positive. "The fat doctor, I could tell, wanted me to cry, but I didn't." The line was typical of what would become a hallmark of her style, "Dr. Man dumb, me brave." The piece is bookended by a dramatic cliffhanger when Finch, rattled by the thought of getting cancer, gets into a car crash. "Officer Frank tells me I'm lucky I'm not dead." As part of IAMA, a theater group in Los Angeles, she wrote another personal trauma into a play, Return to Cinder, about an ex-military guy who suffers from PTSD and stalks his girlfriend. She told a friend it was based on herself and an ex-boyfriend. In 2012, she landed a writing job on The Vampire Diaries, earning the joke nickname Vampire Girl. According to a writer on the show, she was meek in the room, barely said a word. This was a rough atmosphere, with writers routinely fearing they'd end up on the chopping block. Shortly thereafter is when Finch herself got cancer, or so she claimed. Not breast or ovarian cancer, but this rare and more fatal bone cancer, which was discovered after alleged knee replacement surgery. The tumor in her spine had grown so big that surgery risked paralysis, she wrote, so it required chemotherapy right away. Her closest relative at the time was an older cousin in New Jersey who considered Finch a younger sister. "It was devastating," the cousin recalls, learning the diagnosis. As chemotherapy got underway, Finch would occasionally visit from Los Angeles. She was bald, there was a bandage over the place where a chemo port would go, and she looked sick. The cousin's daughter, then 14, idolized Finch, her cool relative with a Hollywood job who made her awesome mixtapes. She recalls the night they went up to her bedroom, and Finch told her that there was a good possibility of her dying, and how special she was to her. "We lay on the bed and cried together," she says. Finch's mother, Joan, was desperate to come to Los Angeles to help care for her, but Finch kept her parents away, which crushed them, according to a source close to the family. When people wondered why she rejected their care, she explained that they were overbearing and impossible to be around. Over the years, her brother, Eric, a doctor in Florida, talked about wanting to speak with her doctors about her treatment, says the source, but she wouldn't let him. In spite of her illness, Finch valiantly flew in for big events back east. Her mother's 60th birthday, graduations, but she'd only stay for a few hours before having to fly off to somewhere important. "We'd take any time we could get with her," says her cousin. It was like, oh my God, she's so fabulous. People close to her chalked it up to Finch's independence. Finch, as recounted in that first article for Elle, A connection she made through her close friend Mickey Rapkin, then a writer there, was instilled to treat adversity with quiet dignity. Finch had told friends that there were two shows she was dying to work for, Grey's Anatomy and Parenthood. Lo and behold, when she landed the job at Grey's Anatomy, a dream came true. There was an obstacle along the way. According to sources at the show, a few seasons into Finch's stint, writer Krista Vernoff took over as showrunner and did a blind read of writers' work to see whose matched her own vision. Finch's didn't make the cut, and she was let go when the show got restaffed. But Finch was rescued when someone at Shondaland resurfaced the old Elle article for Vernoff and asked her to reconsider. The woman literally lives for her work. She was promptly rehired. Like most writers' rooms, the Grey's Anatomy room, which consisted of roughly 17 people, was an intimate, sacred space for people to share all kinds of stories and confessions. For 10 hours a day, the group would churn over past humiliations, scandals that had consumed friends, dark family secrets. They'd mix and match, map them onto the arcs of the show's many characters. Grey's was diverse before its time and suffused with a kind of empathy that made Finch, the only person in the writer's room who identified as a person with a disability, as she wrote it in The Hollywood Reporter, a perfect fit. Unlike at the Vampire Diaries, here she had a presence. She excelled in the area of personal confession, laying her pain bare, often with an appealing, familiar humor. Other times, she'd laugh at something tragic, laughed so hard until she cried. People figured it was a coping mechanism. She carried her heart and her cancer on her sleeve. She was visibly sick and getting sicker. In addition to the baldness and scarves, she wore a bandage over a presumed port on her upper chest. You could see it behind her baggy tank top and cardigan. Her skin had a yellow-greenish hue, which she covered with badly blended makeup. She could sometimes be heard retching in the bathroom, at which point the producers would insist, "Please, go home." "No, no," came the valiant reply. "I really want to be here. Just let me do an hour more." Cancer afforded her certain privileges. She had an extra comfortable chair. From there, she tacitly claimed extra talking rights. The writer's room was like one Jewish nosh table on a Sunday morning, as one writer describes it, with everyone talking over each other. But when Finch had the floor, she was not to be interrupted, and took whatever time she needed drawing out her stories. Anyone else could lose their job for being such a room hog. We all tolerated it because we thought she might be dying. These might be her final words, says this writer. Co-workers recall that her frequent bouts of illness and mental stress coincided with deadlines for her episodes. In these instances, she'd often have to pull in a senior writer to pick up the slack. She showed little interest in returning the favor for other people's episodes. Lest anyone forget that cancer was an ongoing battle, she took frequent weeks-long leaves to do what she claimed were clinical trials. She corralled a group of loving friends to help her. She had rented a condo near the Mayo Clinic from her good friend Nick, whose family, sources say, treated her like a surrogate daughter. Nick would drive her to appointments. She'd get out of the car, enter the building, and then he'd drive off. She might snap a picture of the Mayo Clinic exterior for Instagram with a tag like, "There are giants in the sky." Another friend helped organize care packages. She and a third friend, Molly, became the point people who updated friends and family with information. One day, when Nick was traveling for work and unable to take her to the clinic, Finch asked her cousin in New Jersey to step in. "I couldn't go," recalls the cousin. "I was devastated that I couldn't be there for her." But Finch didn't want anyone to get too close. When friends asked if she wanted company during her treatments, she declined. She didn't want anyone she loved to be connected to her cancer memory, she explained. The friends she collected were empaths. Many had been touched by cancer themselves. The disease created other health complications. In 2017, she needed a kidney transplant. She posted on Facebook two hospital hangouts, nearly 2 weeks of hell, but finally, one happy, healthy kidney. Thanks for all the... And then she puts heart emoji. According to a staffer, Finch said that Anna Paquin was to thank. Paquin and Finch had become friends for real on True Blood. Paquin did not comment to Vanity Fair. Normal life couldn't roll on for too long before Finch's illness reared its head. There were sudden bouts of dangerous overheating or weakness at inopportune moments, like at her relative's college graduation ceremony or on a trip to Jerusalem, also with this family member, when they were swarmed with cyclists in the middle of a bike race. People would flock to her side to attend to her. On the trip back from Israel, she threw a fit when she was made to check her bags because she said her cancer meds were inside. She tweeted later, "Delta, you cannot insist a cancer patient check meds. Lose the bag and insist nothing can be done." At her 40th birthday in March 2018, a pajama party with roughly 100 guests held at an event space in downtown Los Angeles, cancer, was the top of conversation. Over cake, Finch addressed the crowd, including Alan. "Everyone here in the room is someone I know and love, and over the last very bizarre 7 years has been instrumental in helping me get to 40, including, they wish not to be identified personally, but there are two doctors from Mayo Clinic who flew all the way from Minnesota. I promised that I would not show them, but I wanted them to be surrounded by people I love so fiercely, who love me so fiercely." It was one of the few occasions that people from her various pods in life interacted with one another. Finch first wrote chondrosarcoma into Grey's Anatomy in 2016, when a sassy, know-it-all teenage girl amputee announces to two male doctors, "Turns out, I'm one in like a bajillion kids to get chondrosarcoma. We have our work cut out for us, gentlemen." Gradually, Finch's cancer metastasized, taking over the communal creative process in the room. When cancer stories were brought up as potential storylines, Finch seized the territory, say co-workers. There were two other survivors, but she was the one living with cancer now. Once, when a writer pushed back on an emotional direction Finch wanted to take a story, she lashed out, "This is how it feels, and none of you can understand," and stormed out. Eventually, one of the survivors didn't even bother chiming in on cancer-related stories. In 2018 came the Catherine Avery chondrosarcoma storyline. Finch claimed in one of her articles that she resisted sharing her personal story. "I wanted to say no, a big, fat, super emphatic, though ever polite, no. But the loving insistence from her co-workers broke down her walls. I said yes, because Shonda once wrote me an email where she told me, 'Love yourself more,' and when Shonda says something like that, you listen." According to someone in the room, the conversation actually went more like this. "Finch, it would be so amazing to give Catherine my cancer, but maybe I shouldn't write it. It might be too triggering." "Okay, we'll protect you. Someone else can do it." Finch, "No, I can do it." Indeed, Finch needed little arm-twisting to write about her cancer in 8 cancer-themed articles, including "I Confronted the Doctor Who Missed My Cancer," featuring the clueless Dr. Perfect, who cocks his head to the side and says, "You seem angry." There was also deciding to have an abortion while getting chemo, redefining Brave, and All My Eggs in One Basket, about her cancer and fertility choices. The latter she wrote from a perch at Hedgebrook, the prestigious and highly competitive writer's retreat for women trying to bring out positive change in the world. She used her illness as the basis of her application. Likewise, cancer meant opportunities to pick fights online, with tweets now deleted like, "Talk to me when you've screamed yourself to sleep at night from the pain, and I'll argue about the merits of legalizing marijuana every damn where." And, "I've officially run out of ways to politely say this, Stop tweeting me miracle cancer cures. It's exhausting and insulting and presumptuous AF. For Finch, as for many people, the Trump years were a time of greater outspokenness. Days after his victory in 2016, an unknown person allegedly left an ugly anti-Semitic tract outside her door. She posted the offensive picture, along with, "Yes, I am the only Jewish person in my building, located in Santa Monica. Yes, I am the only one who received this on my doorstep." In March 2018, in the heat of hashtag MeToo, she wrote in The Hollywood Reporter about the alleged harassment she endured years prior by a director on the set of another show, which included misogynistic verbal abuse and unwanted touching. When Brett Kavanaugh was nominated to the Supreme Court, she repurposed her cancer abortion story for a PSA-style video, reminding people that her ability to have an abortion saved her life. By then, she was cancer-free. Her hair had grown out. Well, let's rephrase that. By then, her hair had grown out, but she told viewers, "I may never be cancer-free." On the day Christine Blasey Ford testified, Finch couldn't not offer words on Facebook. "Men, find a way today to tell the women in your life that you believe them. Don't assume they know. Not today. Believe survivors." Then, in late October 2018, a national tragedy hit when 11 people were shot and killed at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, the city where Finch went to college. The next day, she began telling people that an older friend she'd met while in college had been one of the victims. She mustered up her fury. "Please do not send me photos of the man who murdered my friend," she tweeted at a hapless account. Gray's writers had to be careful with their language. If someone mentioned guns in the room or complained that their pitch had been shot down, she dramatically winced, according to one colleague. Within a few months, the narrative had new details. She had helped clean up the remains of her friend's body from the synagogue floor. "It was all in step with the Jewish tradition," she explained, which said Jews must be buried within 24 hours with all their body parts. Subsequent shootings brought the trauma right back up. In March 2019, shortly after the mosque shootings in New Zealand, she tweeted, "I spent sun up to sundown cleaning up what was left of my friend after the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting. And as someone who stood amidst the Pittsburgh synagogue carnage, I'll just say, my heart is broken. My brain is broken. I have no words for my outrage." Eventually, Catherine Avery's cancer plot would play itself out. Just like the amazing Finchie, the amazing Catherine would live with cancer while maintaining her rock star career. But another character became interesting to her, a troubled young surgeon named Joe Wilson, and she proposed a storyline. After meeting a patient who's a rape victim, Joe starts confronting her own past as an abused wife and learns that she's a product of rape, a pitch, Finch said, that was based on a friend. According to a staffer, writing that first episode was stress-inducing for Finch. She turned to the others in the room to help write it, although hers was the only name credited. Still, she claimed the rest of Joe's storyline for the season. Discussions were had in the room about Joe needing to check herself into a mental health facility to deal with her trauma. Now Finch just needed the rest. Finch told her employer that she was suffering from PTSD related to Pittsburgh and needed 6 weeks off. She checked herself into a mental health clinic in Arizona. She was no longer wearing a bandage. The name she used was Joe. Next picture, Anatomy of a Scandal. Elizabeth Finch with Grey's Anatomy colleagues, including Debbie Allen, whose character embodied some of Finch's issues, and actor and director Kevin McKidd. In January 2019, Jennifer Beyer arrived at an Arizona mental health treatment center, believing she'd never get to see her kids alone again. She was suffering severe PTSD from all she'd been through in her 18-year marriage. No one understood what she knew, but couldn't articulate for so long, that Brendan was an abuser and master gaslighter in the original sense of the word. In their small, liberal community in Topeka, most people saw him as a doting father with the right values. While she worked at the hospital, the best nurse I ever worked with, says a former colleague, Brendan was a member of the grassroots advocacy group Indivisible and was often picketing with the kids in tow. But behind closed doors, he controlled Jennifer's every movement, she says, and was physically and sexually violent. At his insistence, she explained away her bruises and broken bones as a result of falls in the shower or down the stairs. When she let on to others the truth about his behavior, they couldn't believe it. His line was that she was mentally ill, suffering from postpartum depression, and she was making it all up. He told her that if she revealed the truth, she wouldn't make it. Fearing for her life, she took out a protection order against him and filed for divorce. This forced him out of the house, but he moved nearby and made sure she knew he was watching her. Next photo, survivor, Jennifer Beyer, Finch's estranged wife, discovered the truth, or truths. All of that led to the haunting incident that brought her to the Arizona Treatment Center. She began having dissociative episodes, breaks from one's reality and surroundings. On December 27, 2018, a date that's etched into her brain, she was driving her car with two of her young sons strapped in the back. Then suddenly, without realizing it, she pulled the car over, opened the door, and walked some distance. A few minutes later, she came to, and panic jolted through her. Where are my kids? Hysterical, she immediately called the police, who were sympathetic. Within minutes, the kids were located and she was reunited with them. The next day, she was called into the Office of Child Protective Service. Believing she was safe, she shared what had happened. But afterward, she was informed that CPS was charging her with child abandonment. She was psychotic, Brendan told people, and now there was evidence. With a divorce proceeding looming and everything on the line, she entered a mental health facility to prove she was sane and a fit mother. The woman sitting across from me in a Topeka coffee shop on a rainy March day is extremely fragile, soft-spoken. There's a service dog at her feet to help her with continued PTSD. As she gets going, though, she seems the antithesis of how Brendan tried to paint her to the outside world. She's warm, articulate, and emotionally intelligent, which is part of the reason she's scared to tell her story. She's scared of repercussions, scared of appearing so gullible to the world. But it's also why she knows she has to. She wants to make sure that the person who targeted her can never do that to somebody else, and that person wasn't Brendan. The Jennifer Beyer who entered treatment is a far cry from the Jennifer Beyer of today. Then she was unable to function, a walking live wire. She couldn't sit with anyone or make eye contact. The mere sound of a door scared her. A sudden noise would send a flash of panic through her body. In her small therapeutic process group, she was unable to talk about everything that had happened. Beyer was afraid of what this meant. Maybe she really was hopelessly crazy. The therapist, particularly one named Carly, started to grasp what had happened to her. According to Beyer, Carly could see this was PTSD with dissociative episodes, and she was determined to do whatever it took to bring Beyer back to health, even if it took months. Disturbing news from home didn't help. Brendan had been arrested and had torn up an emergency room. The kids were sent to a foster home, but after a few days, they would have to split up. They ended up with Brendan's mother. About 6 months into Beyer's stay, a new resident named Joe arrived and became part of Beyer's process group. Joe, the first name of a Grey's Anatomy character that Finch was researching, was also suffering from PTSD after the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, she said. Her friend was one of the victims, she explained, and in accordance with Jewish tradition, Joe had helped clean up the body from the synagogue floor. To Beyer, the signs of Joe's PTSD started to seem exactly like her own. Joe had to sit alone in a big group. Joe, too, was unable to make eye contact or sit by doors, couldn't deal with sudden noises, and struggled to talk about the details of her drama. The similarity gave Beyer comfort. After all, if someone like Joe, who had told people she was a professional writer and who didn't seem insane, was having the same challenges, maybe Beyer wasn't crazy after all. The two women started talking and talking. For the first time ever, therapists saw Beyer laugh, she recalls. Joe suggested they become roommates. It was not the norm for two people in the same process group to become roommates, but the staff could see how beneficial Joe's friendship was to Beyer's healing. As they grew closer, Beyer noticed that as the trauma from Pittsburgh receded, another one was coming into view for Joe, that her brother, Eric, had been cruel and violent to her as a child, something she had never grappled with until now. It was another similarity. Beyer had Brendan, Joe had Eric, and it brought them closer. Family weekend was approaching, and Joe's parents planned to come visit. Two of Finch's compartments were about to meet for the first time. It would take some tap dancing. First, Joe needed to explain the whole name thing. She revealed to Beyer she was an important writer on Grey's Anatomy and that she was using a pseudonym so that word didn't get out. Joe said she had given the same explanation to her parents before their arrival and asked that they address her as Joe, not Elizabeth. In the first meeting, when Joe went on about Eric's cruelty during childhood, Joan and Robert listened, bewildered, Beyer recalls. Sure, there were sibling fights, but they had not witnessed any of the suffering she was describing. Still, Joan was placating to Finch's perception of her childhood. The next day, Joan opened up about how much she had worried about her daughter over the years, about the cancer, how she would have wanted to be there for her. Cancer? It was the first time anyone in treatment, including Beyer, had heard about it. Finch replied that yes, she was living with cancer, but she didn't want to talk about it. Beyer respected that. Just like Beyer, Joe was living with enormous pain. Carly, as a matter of course, had been in possession of Beyer's phone and had been receiving all kinds of angry, obsessive texts from Brendan. If a message seemed pertinent, Carly would sit with Beyer and read it to her, something Joe seemed to find interesting, Beyer says. Now a video came in of Brendan saying, "I'm coming to get you." Beyer met with the head of security. The staff arranged to have increased security around the facility. And then, in another remarkable coincidence, Finch claimed that Eric was closing in on her. Her parents had left a family photo album upon their departure. As Finch told it, she was just flipping through it, and inside she found a handwritten letter composed by him, threatening her. Beyer saw Finch holding this letter, but she didn't ask to hear the details. There was only so much fear of men Beyer could handle. Eric Finch and his parents did not respond to Vanity Fair. By early July 2019, both women were ready to leave the center and head back to their respective towns. The staff had been in the process of helping Beyer obtain a service dog to help her keep present when she was having episodes. The dog was expensive. Finch interceded and asked Carly if she could pay for it. Beyer was deeply moved by this parting gesture. It solidified a profound connection. The women had an emotional farewell. They made plans to keep in touch, to not let their friendship die. Finch returned to Hollywood and began filling in the contours of her newly recovered trauma. To a friend, she elaborated on the menacing letter found in the photo album, which had said, "Keep your mouth shut." She added a specific, ugly detail about Eric's abuse. a detail that was identical to something Beyer had confided that Brendan did to her when they were married. Meanwhile, Beyer returned to Topeka, and oh, how she missed Joe, the name she continued using for her friend. She moved into a shelter, unable to see her kids except for 1 hour a week under supervision, and faced numerous in-person court dates with Brendan, the thought of which terrified her. Brendan continued taunting her. He now posted photos on social media of random spots near the shelter, signaling that he knew where she was. Finch reeled in Beyer's love just when Beyer needed it. She invited Beyer to come stay at her house in California, a beautiful spread she'd seen pictures of in their room at the treatment center. It was just the escape Beyer needed. The house was in Ojai, the most heavenly place she'd ever seen. There was a big gate at the entrance, a gorgeous sprawling yard with orange trees and a swimming pool. Beyer wondered how she could afford it all. Finch told her that it was Anna Paquin's house. That much was true, but that she owned part of it. Finch does not own part of Paquin's house, a source confirms, nor does Paquin have anything to do with Finch's kidneys. There were a couple of black cars out on the street. Finch claimed it was security, a luxury she had at all times. The pair spent the weekend cooking, swimming, lounging, laughing, and falling in love. They took dozens of selfies of their love. Wouldn't it be great to make a slideshow and send it to Carly to show her how happy we are, suggested Finch, who talked a lot about Carly that week. And later she did send it. The joy I felt that weekend was incredible, Beyer recalls. When Beyer returned to Kansas and the shelter, Finch love-bombed her with text and sentimental gifts, including a purple stuffed kidney. As they talked about the future, Finch underlined the importance of honesty, writing in a text that channeled Shakespeare, "My expectations are and always will be this. Don't lie to me. That's all I ask. It can annoy us or bum us out or even hurt us, but the truth will out, always." After Brendan, Beyer was scared of getting close to someone again. These were the exact words she needed to hear. Finch's love fortified Beyer as she faced her demons. In preparation for the first court date, Finch came out to Kansas for emotional support. She stayed in the Cyrus Hotel, Topeka's nicest, where the lovers' relationship flourished. On the day, Beyer entered the courthouse, accompanied by Finch and a couple of close friends. She was terrified to see Brendan, and there he was. He got in Beyer's face, repeating in an urgent monotone, "I need to talk to my wife. I need to talk to my wife." Finch physically got between them and told him to back off. "You need to go." Finch seemed so fearless, so in charge. Beyer's friends were completely bowled over. Beyer was so lucky to have this woman in her life, they thought, this tough, famous Hollywood writer who was willing to come all the way here to support the woman she loved. As a friend recalls, "After all she had been through with Brendan, we felt like Jen deserved something good." September 5, 2019. Another court date with Brendan was approaching, and Beyer needed the hit of support that only Finch could provide. Beyer flew to Los Angeles and was being driven to the Grey's Anatomy production office when she got a phone call from the Kansas Department of Children and Families, DCF, in Topeka. She was told to return to Kansas immediately. "Your husband has killed himself. Your kids are safe." Hysterical, she texted Finch with the news. When the car pulled up to the Grey's Anatomy building, Finch came running out, hugged her, and then quickly ushered her into her private office before she could interact with anyone. Once inside her office, Finch got Carly on the phone. Meanwhile, Finch bustled around the office, telling people an emergency had come up and she needed two tickets back to Kansas immediately. Finch returned to Kansas with Beyer and stayed while Beyer processed the news with her children. Finch was meeting them for the first time. Brendan had trashed every inch of the house that Beyer would soon be moving back into. 2 weeks after the suicide, still in Topeka, Finch, unbeknownst to Beyer, wrote the following email to the writing staff at Grey's Anatomy. "Hey all, I've been absent and coming back tomorrow. I just don't know who's looped into what, and I'd rather put it out there so no one is in the dark or feeling eggshelly. I've gone because my brother died by suicide. He was on life support for a short while, but ultimately did not survive. I say this not because I need or want anything from anyone. I'm not a delicate flower or whatever. I just want people to know I'm still here, still part of the team. I intended to just power through my episode shoot, but I recognized I needed to just take a bit of time away to process. Missed y'all. Finchie." She later elaborated to her Grey's Anatomy friends that because Eric was a doctor, he knew exactly how to shoot himself without killing himself, forcing her to be the one to pull the plug. It was his final act of vindictiveness, like trashing a house. We cried with her, one recalls. Finch was now fully committed to two divergent realities, one with her girlfriend and another with her Grey's Anatomy family. Keeping both realities intact required a bold sleight of hand. Shortly after Brendan's suicide, Finch took Byer on a trip to Hawaii, where they stayed at the fanciest hotel she'd ever seen. Finch told Byer it was a work trip. Meanwhile, she told work she was going to Hawaii because she had to reunite her dead brother's illegitimate Filipino baby with the baby's mother in Hawaii. Back in the Byer reality, Finch's brother was very much alive, but dangerous. On one visit to Finch's apartment in Santa Monica, the women entered to find a pigsty strewn with empty alcohol bottles. Byer was upset. She had made clear to Finch that she hated alcohol, that the smell of it was triggering for her. Finch came up with a quick explanation. Eric must have broken in and trashed the place. At this point, Byer panicked about their romantic involvement. Getting her kids back was her number one goal. After Brendan, she couldn't afford to be with a person who had someone so dangerous in her life. Sometime later, Finch assured her that everything was going to be okay. Eric had gone to the Philippines, and per a legal order, he could not return without her being notified. Byer accepted this explanation and went on. After all, she needed Finchie, and Finchie loved her. Then Finch, in a curious move, brought her worlds together. In November 2019, Finch was to receive a Sentinel Award, an award for television that educates viewers to make safer choices for their lives. For her first Joe episode, Silent All These Years, and she invited Byer to come out. Byer was reluctant. A red carpet Hollywood awards thing was beyond intimidating. But Finch said she wanted her to have a dazzling evening and to get all pretty. She bought Byer heels and took her to the hairdresser. A friend let her borrow a dress. Going into the event, Finch led the way. Byer noted how she breezed them in quickly, so quickly they didn't talk to anyone and went straight to their seats. On their way home, they shared a car with Debbie Allen, who sat between them. Finch breathlessly controlled the conversation, asking Byer to show Allen pictures of her children and their talents. The television star oohed and aahed over them, a surreal moment for Byer. Later that month in Kansas, in preparation for the kids coming out of foster care, Byer led the cleanup of the house Brendan had trashed. The act had become a ceremonial communal affair. A dumpster was delivered. Many people, including nurses from the hospital, helped fix doors and faucets and scrubbed every inch. Finch, in her yellow rubber gloves, took a starring role. A friend had brought a chainsaw, which Byer used to cut up her bed, the site of marital rape. Finch took the video of it all, which they discussed sending to Carly. Like that day in court, Byer's friends couldn't believe how generous Finch had been to fly in from Hollywood like that, especially after she told them that she was missing the Emmys that night, and she had been nominated for one. An Emmy? They all knew this was a huge deal, although no one bothered to check the internet. The Emmys had already taken place, 2 months earlier. Byer's daughter, her oldest child, was so touched that she made up an Emmy victory dance for Finchie in front of the dumpster. As one Kansas friend who was there posted on Facebook, "The more I get to know Finchie, the more I realize she is actually a superhero masquerading as a regular person." On Thanksgiving, Finch proposed. They wanted to get married as soon as possible so that they could set the wheels in motion for legal adoption. If something ever happened to Byer, Finch said, she wanted to make sure the kids would never end up back in foster care. After all Byer had been through, the thought soothed her. Finch consulted Rhymes about her adoption lawyer. The kids started calling Finch Joe Mama. Soon after their engagement, Byer had her first doubt about Finch's veracity. Byer's oldest son had landed a role in The Nutcracker to be performed over Christmas at the Topeka Performing Arts Center. It was a momentous occasion for Byer, who hadn't seen him dance in a year. She'd planned a party with family and friends to celebrate his accomplishment. During the party, Finch said she was having excruciating pain. "It's probably kidney stones," she said. Byer said she should go to the hospital and that she'd go with her. Finch vehemently resisted the idea, but Byer insisted. When they were face to face with the doctor at the hospital, Finch, to Byer's exasperation, wasn't saying anything about her medical history. Byer stepped in to say that Finch had cancer and only one working kidney. The doctor said, "Let's go into the donut of truth," referring to the donut-shaped CT machine. When the results came back, he looked at Byer and asked pointedly, "Are you married?" Byer said no, but that they planned to be soon. Looking squarely at Byer, the doctor said, "Her kidneys look fine," stressing the plural. After they were discharged, Finch dismissed his wording. "He probably just meant that my one working kidney looked fine," she said. Finch later groused, "They don't care about my pain." Byer pushed the strange incident to the back of her head, and in February 2020, they got married on the beach in Palos Verdes. It was just them and two sparkly Hollywood names, Mickey Rapkin, who wrote the book on which Pitch Perfect was based, and Rapkin's husband, the actor Jason Butler Harner, who performed the ceremony. Soon the women would start looking for a house in Los Angeles, big enough for the whole family. Rhymes excitedly shared with Finch information about which Los Angeles schools would be a good fit. Those first months of marriage coincided with the arrival of COVID. Finch's cancer took center stage. Grey's Anatomy producers talked about getting her a hotel room in Topeka to protect her from being around the kids. Her colleagues were perpetually worried about Finch and COVID, according to one. Meanwhile, Byer's kids took pains to protect her. Her daughter chose to stop attending school in person for her benefit. When one of Byer's sons came down with COVID, the boy's main fear was for Finch, that he might cause her death. The summer and fall of 2020 brought more stress. The anniversary of her brother's suicide was so traumatic that Finch wouldn't be able to meet deadlines, she told co-workers. As the National Guard rolled into cities and George Floyd protests turned violent, Finch found fresh triggers for the Pittsburgh trauma. Firecrackers, loud sounds from movies, a rainy night, all could bring her crime scene back. A dream catcher with a Tree of Life design that Byer had on the wall was too upsetting for Finch. She made Byer take it down for a period. On one occasion, Byer's daughter's school suddenly went on lockdown when a suspicious character was spotted on school grounds. While Byer and other parents descended on the school, confused and panicked about their children's safety, Finch stayed home, citing her Pittsburgh trauma. One day, with a tinge of suspicion, Byer began scrolling through Finch's Facebook. She scrolled all the way back to the day of the shooting, October 27, 2018, and found that Finch had been out with Rapkin. The next day, The day she was supposedly cleaning up her dead friend's body, she was again out with friends. A chill went through Byers' body. She continued scrolling, more frantically now. Here were pictures of Finch when she had a bald head, yet her eyebrows and eyelashes were still full. As a nurse, she knew that chemo patients who lose their hair often experience the loss of other body hair, like brows and lashes. She found pictures that showed the bandage over what was presumably a port scar. A port scar? Finch didn't have one. Byer knew her body as intimately as a person could. The bandage itself looked shoddy, wrinkled, and open at the edge in places which would allow for infections. She'd put such bandages on patients many times and knew the correct way to do it. This was not. A hideous fear began sinking in. Byer gathered herself as she prepared for a confrontation. She had a plan in mind. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico.